Whoever wins in November in Boston Bay to the Mexican Gulf, all the peepers will say, the people have spoken and shown us their will. From the Great Plains of Wyoming to the Capitol Hill, whoever wins in November, the moon it will rise, and the mothers will weep to the sound of the cries of the kids in their mansions and the kids in their shacks. Farm workers will toil with the sun on their backs. Whoever wins in November, the frat boys at Yale will all toast to democracy and tell many a tale. The bombs will keep falling, the flags they will wave, and they'll cheer on their new leader, the latest corporate slave. Will widen and the forests will burn until the time comes when we finally learn that whoever wins in November, neo-lib, neo-con, stands only for death. Whichever face he has on, we will build a new world and set us all free once we drive the whole lot of them right out of D.C. Whoever wins in November.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis, Sacramento, and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, a trio of reports with Steve Curwood. In the first report, he talks to Jerry Brown about how the British Columbia and California and some other states are joining together to put a price on carbon. Then he talks about how the EPA is scrapping chemical safety rules. And finally, he talks to a psychologist about how to cope with global climate change and all the other environmental problems.
With more than 38 million people, California is the biggest and richest member of the Pacific Coast Climate and Energy Compact and the most advanced of the American states in terms of climate protection laws. So we called up its governor, Jerry Brown, to ask just what his goals are for the deal.
The goal here is to reach beyond the border of California and join with the states of Oregon and Washington and the province of British Columbia and deal with this problem of climate change, global warming, and greenhouse gases. This problem is very unique in the sense that no one place, no one state, or even one country can solve it. It takes a lot. It takes everybody, ultimately. But in the beginning, we want to spread to as many other states working together to figure out how to reduce climate change.
A big part of your plan is to reduce carbon dioxide emissions by putting a price on carbon. California has cap and trade. British Columbia has a tax on carbon. But what about the other states? How are they going to deal with this?
Well, you know, through regulation, through, for example, requiring more efficient buildings, by requiring more efficient appliances, different land use rules so people don't drive as much, encouraging electric cars, encouraging more efficient water use that cuts down on the need for power. There's many, many things you can do. And ultimately, of course, putting a price on carbon is essential, but that will take time. And we're taking the first steps, and we hope over the months and years ahead, we're going to get to the point where we really do all the things we need to.
Now, part of the argument we hear on a national level is that putting a price on carbon is going to hurt business. How do you explain? How do you respond to that?
Well, putting a price on things, everything's got a price. Oil companies raise the price. They lower the price, sometimes by much as 50 cents a gallon in the space of 10 months. But we have a problem that carbon going into the atmosphere is trapping heat, which is changing radically and irreversibly the climate on which we all depend. Therefore, we have to reduce carbon emissions, and you do that by laws, by regulations, and by putting a burden on it called a tax or a price or a fee.
Why not wait on the federal government to do this?
Well, the federal government is currently dysfunctional and paralyzed, and this is an existential threat to humanity. It's real. And I know there are some deniers out there, many of the people in the oil business, of course, because they're contributing to the problem in a major, major way. So we have to do what we can where we are. California is 12% of the country, and we're going to start pushing. And we're joining now with other states. We have a memorandum of understanding with various provinces in China. I've reached out to different states in Mexico. We can't wait.
So how do you bring China into something with California as well?
Well, China is involved. President of China came to California last year, and I spent almost an hour with him discussing this very issue. So China is far more active than the United States. They're the world's foremost producer of wind machines and solar installations, solar collectors. They're moving ahead. Now, they're also burning lots of coal, and that's bad. But in many ways, it's going to take China and various progressive states in the Western Hemisphere to join together with Germany and countries in Europe. And that's the way I think we're going to turn this thing around.
So I take it you expect that the Pacific Coast Action Plan is going to affect America, the world, and you're leading by example here.
Exactly. Now, when you put it that way, it sounds grandiose. But first of all, there's no other way forward. It's either stagnation, give up, or take the lead. And as governor of California, I'm following my predecessors in asserting an important role for the state in curbing pollution, in innovating in so many different ways. So, yes, we have a long, long way to go. I mean, the carbon buildup is enormous. It's constant, tremendous momentum. But California is a big state. China is suffering from such pollution that in their effort to combat that, they will at the same time develop the same technologies and practices that will curb greenhouse gases. So there's plenty of hope, but it's not coming from Washington. It's coming from California. It's coming from these states that signed up, and British Columbia and China and Ms. Merkel over there in Germany. There's a lot of positives in the midst of this utter mindless resistance, which is so difficult to overcome.
Before you go, Governor, how do you feel about all of this? When you wake up in the morning and think about your priorities, how do you feel about this one?
Well, after I get a cup of coffee,
yeah.
I feel better.
Okay.
There is a feeling aspect to this, but it's also a matter of assessing where are we in the world and where are we today in 2013 in the great sweep of history. And we are on a precipice that, if not understood and reacted to, will irreversibly degrade the future prospects for everyone, and not just those living in America. And I don't think that has to be the future. So you ask me how I feel. Well, I feel I've got the energy, and I've got the imagination and intensity to do a lot, having been granted the governorship of California, at least for the next year. So I'm making use of the time available to move in another direction against the arrayed powers of fossil fuel companies, mindless politicians, and just cynical propagandists. And I believe I see a path forward.
Jerry Brown is the governor of California. Thanks so much, Governor.
Okay, thank you.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
From the Jennifer and Ted Stanley studios in Boston, this is Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. Certain synthetic chemicals can mimic hormones and disrupt human health and development. But the Obama administration is now blocking rules that would label such chemicals and require public notification of the results of any research on their health effects. The EPA proposed the rules years ago, but now it has decided to withdraw them after they were bottled up in the White House Office of Management and Budget, or OMB. The Senate Judiciary Committee has been investigating what it calls the human cost of regulatory paralysis, and scientists at the Environmental Defense Fund and other NGOs are urging the Senate committee to probe why these rules were dropped. Richard Dennison of the Environmental Defense Fund explained the significance of the rule regarding hormone-mimicking chemicals.
So this was a pretty simple rule that would simply have had EPA identify publicly several chemicals to be officially deemed chemicals of concern, based on a finding that these chemicals may present a risk to human health or the environment. And they proposed to list bisphenol A, some phthalates that are used as plastic additives and in cosmetics and other products, and some brominated flame retardants used in furniture foam and computer casings and the like.
Well, what is the current scientific thinking about bisphenol A and phthalates and those flame retardants? What are the dangers?
So each of these chemicals is increasingly of concern because of evidence that even fairly small doses of these chemicals can interfere with our normal functioning of the systems in our body that keep us healthy. These chemicals act by manner that is similar to the way in which hormones act in our bodies. And they can actually interfere with the normal development of our reproductive systems, our neurological systems, our immune systems, and so forth. The developing fetus and infants and very young children are particularly susceptible to those effects. This is all new science, and there's a lot of research that still needs to be done. But I think it's a major warning sign that the evidence that those chemicals are safe is likely to be having a significant aggregate impact on our health.
Tell me about the other rule. I understand it would compel companies to divulge more about the ingredients in their chemicals, if I had that right.
That's close. What this rule would have done is to require that if a company submitted a health and safety study on a new chemical to EPA, that study would have to be made public, and the identity of that chemical that was the subject of the study would also have to be made public. There's a tension between companies' legitimate interest in protecting the identity of the chemicals that they're developing before those chemicals get on the market, and the competing interest of the public and workers and consumers to have a right to know about the health and environmental impacts of chemicals they might be exposed to. I think that made this rule controversial, and it ended up in limbo for 2 years in the, excuse me, almost 4 years in the review process at the White House, and ended up being one of the two rules that EPA withdrew last week.
Now, this isn't a unique situation. A number of rules have been held up by the White House regarding the EPA.
That's right, Steve. These two rules being withdrawn are indicative of a much broader systematic delay by the White House in reviewing rules that EPA is developing under clear statutory authority. So the dispute here is not whether EPA has the authority to issue rules. The dispute is over the ability of a White House office to interfere with the normal rulemaking process that EPA would otherwise have to follow. Many of these proposals that are languishing at OMB or have been under review far longer than the executive order that gave OMB this power allow are simply proposals that have yet to be even vetted through the public comment process that is the norm to be used with every rule that gets developed. That ought to be the way the process works. Instead of a small office buried within the White House behind closed doors, simply sitting on these rules and refusing to clear them so that they can be proposed for public comment. That's a very non-transparent and, I think, undemocratic process, and yet it's become a routine practice, especially with EPA rules governing chemical safety.
Why do you think the Obama administration, an administration that pledged to have transparency in these agencies, is backing down on this type of rulemaking?
Well, it's baffling. It's a very good question, Steve. I do think, in general, there's been lots of pressure coming from Congress to scale back regulations. And I think in some ways, probably some of this response by the White House has been a political one. The tragedy here, though, is these are not examples of heavy command and control regulation. In fact, the power of EPA's using this authority to simply tell the market, these are chemicals of concern, and we expect that if you're going to continue to want to use them or produce them, you need to be providing the information necessary for us to determine that those uses are safe. That would have sent a very good signal to the market that, in fact, there's growing concern about these chemicals, and that it should be the onus of those that want to continue to use them to demonstrate their safety, rather than consumers and the public bearing the burden should they prove to be unsafe.
Richard Dennison is a senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund in Washington. Thanks for joining us today.
I'm so happy to have been here, Steve. Thanks so much.
Often as not, the news we report could hardly be classified as good news. And with so many stories about global climate disruption, species extinction, and habitat loss, it's no wonder that many people may be feeling eco-anxiety these days. Well, Mary Pfeiffer has an answer. She's a psychologist and best-selling author of Reviving Ophelia, a groundbreaking book about adolescent girls. And her newest book is called The Green Boat, Reviving Ourselves in Our Capsized Culture. It's all about how we can have hope, save the earth, and restore our mental health at the same time. She joins me now from a studio in her home state of Nebraska. Welcome to Living on Earth, Mary.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's really good to be on your show.
Now, you called the first chapter of your book Trauma, and it's all about the psychological impact of our current environmental crisis. So first, explain, why is this traumatic?
Well, I think all of us could be called members of, let's call it Generation One. No matter where we live, no matter who we are the first generation in the history of the world to be faced with a planetary crisis, which we must deal with rapidly and everywhere. And we all know this, even when we claim we don't know this. For example, one of the books I found very helpful was a book by a guy named Stanley Cohen called States of Denial. And he actually looked at what was happening in Nazi Germany during the genocide of the Jews. And what he found was there was a phenomena that could be called willful ignorance. When something is going on that is too horrible to process and yet too obvious to totally ignore. And that state of willful ignorance, I think, is something that many of us feel. In fact, all of us feel. It's a matter of degree, but all of us go in and out of that state of willful ignorance around global climate change. When we truly think of it, we're really talking about losing our Mother Earth, our planet, losing everything we love. Personally, that's overwhelming news.
In your book, you say that as a society, we're basically in denial about climate disruption. In fact, we all know that some people don't believe in it at all. But actually, you're getting at something deeper than that. Could you explain?
I have in the book a list of some of the kinds of things that we do to block out awareness. We compartmentalize. We have times, all of us, when we want to eat some jumbo shrimp without thinking about the mango groves in Thailand, or we want to read our grandchildren or children a story about polar bears without thinking about the melting ice caps. So we all move in and out of a kind of a state of denial, and that's totally understandable. In fact, it's totally human, and it's probably adaptive. I never make the case that there's something wrong with people for being in denial. I make the case it's very understandable and that we all are in denial some of the time. But what I do say is that unless we come out of that denial some of the time and face our situation squarely, we'll be unable to solve it and deal with it. I have a quote I really like by James Baldwin. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed that is not faced.
So what can people do who in fact recognize that there is a problem but feel paralyzed? What's the best therapy here?
See, that's probably the most important question you could ask, because people get what I call distractionable intelligence, which just makes them feel badly and feel powerless. And I'm really a big fan of actionable intelligence that gives people an idea what to do next. And the main thing I encourage people to do is become engaged with some kind of local work to help the planet. I say action is my antidote to despair.
So, Mary Pfeiffer, you prescribed action for yourself, and you found yourself helping to mobilize the Nebraska opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. How did you get going with this type of activism? Could you describe it for us, please?
Well, thank you, Steve. It was a response, actually, to my own despair, and I felt that the best way I could heal myself, in a sense, from feeling miserable, which is not a state I like to be in, was to invite a few friends over and start talking about doing something. And in our state, the biggest, most urgent environmental issue was the Keystone XL pipeline. So we started out with just two or three people, and we ended up building a statewide coalition of people who have, at least thus far, successfully fought and kept that pipeline out of our state.
I was struck by your descriptions of the camaraderie that you developed between a pretty diverse coalition there in your state dealing with the Keystone XL pipeline. How did that come together?
Well, first of all, one of the big things I believe about groups and action is the most important thing is it be really good and reinforcing to the members so they'll keep doing it. So we always had potlucks and we drank some wine or we'd meet in parks. And we tried to plan a lot of fun actions because everybody's real tired and busy and they wouldn't want to be involved with things that were just one more meeting in an office and dreary. And we were always planning ahead and planning events, so we always had things going on that we were looking forward to. But the biggest surprise for all of us with this group was I live in Nebraska, which is a very conservative state, and our biggest and first allies were conservative ranchers and farmers who really understood the water issues in our state. So we formed a new kind of alliance here in Nebraska between very conservative rural people and people like myself who are urban and progressive. And that was really something, Steve, to see that develop.
By the way, I noticed you got Nigerians in your coalition in Nebraska, huh?
Yeah, I met these Nigerians when I wrote a book called The Middle of Everywhere. And we had a whole lot of events one weekend at a festival, a viral festival, where events happened all over the state. But one of the events was Africans Against the Pipeline with our African refugee community. And some of the people who participated in that, the Ogoni people, had been people who were run out of Nigeria and many of their leaders killed because they had tried to stop a pipeline from coming down their river and in their area many years ago and were driven out of Nigeria and ended up as refugees in Lincoln. And they came and they very ardently spoke about how important it was to stop this pipeline. They said, first we saw the plants die, then we saw the animals die, then we saw the people die. It was a very dramatic event and a fun event too, I might add, to have all those cowboys and Africans together in the same park.
You started this process pretty depressed by your own description. How you doing now?
Well, bless your heart for asking. You know, I'm about as happy as anybody else, I guess is how I'd put it. Happy some days, not so much the other. But I'll tell you, feeling you're powerless is a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you think you're powerless, you are darn well going to be powerless. On the other hand, if you start acting as if you have power and influence, you engage in a hopeful process, and you're likely to find other people like that who will engage in that hopeful process with you. And those people start being very close friends. And we've had a lot of fun, and we've really grown to care about each other. And all in all, this experience of both riding the Green Boat and fighting the Keystone XL has been one of the more transcendent experiences of my life, Steve.
Transcendence, that's what you labeled one of your chapters. Why is this so profound? Why do you think it has such a profound effect on you?
For me, the three transcendent responses are action, getting involved, increasing one's own moral imagination, becoming kinder and more connected to other people, and in fact, other living beings. And then the third is finding more and more ways to be amazed and blissed out by the universe, because if you're doing the hard work that our group has done, and than anyone does that looks honestly at the world, I think that needs to be balanced by lots of experience in which you're just having a wonderful time, looking at the stars or sitting by water or enjoying your fresh-grown tomatoes with your friends. So I think all three of those are really wonderful ways to move beyond despair and sorrow and into something bigger.
At one point, you write let me quote you here, "The necessary conditions for revival are not economic ones, but rather mindfulness and community." You know, some might say that mindfulness and community can certainly help, but they might not be enough to solve a problem as serious as the climate crisis. What would you say?
But what is a better solution? You know what I think is going to happen? Here's what I think is going to happen. First of all, nobody knows if we can solve these problems or not. And I'm not a Pollyanna. I don't claim to know any more than other people who've looked into things know. And nobody claims to know that is being honest and knows what they're talking about. We really have no idea what time it is in terms of the history of hominids and many other species. We have no idea what time it is. But what I do think will save us, if anything will save us, is people all over the world waking up, realizing the situation they're in, and realizing that they want to work together to build a sustainable future. And the interesting thing about that, Steve, is that is not some kind of pie-in-the-sky fantasy. I mean, that is happening all over the world. I can't hardly get on my internet or get on the World Wide Web without news of some great new group that's forming or some new coalition of groups that's forming somewhere on Earth to protect the planet. So I think it's very likely that there will be a changing consciousness in the next few years when we need that consciousness to change, and that especially when we all know about each other and can connect and inspire each other, I think change could move very rapidly. Change has moved very rapidly in the history of the world, as you know.
Now, not everyone has the ability to get involved with a big political cause like the Keystone XL pipeline fight, as you've gotten involved. So what advice do you have for people about maybe some littler things they can do in their lives?
First of all, there's always a cause nearby. Sadly, there's enough issues and problems out there that probably within 10 blocks of your home, you can find a good environmental cause to be involved with. One very simple thing I'm involved with now that's virtually an issue everywhere is working with local power companies to encourage them to use a lot more sustainable and clean energy. But the main thing I tell people about getting involved is do what you love. Do what you have the skills to do and love to do and have a passion for. Because there's so many causes, there's so many issues, and all of the gifts of all of us will be required to make this work. So if you have a gift for art, if you have a gift for baking pies, if you have a gift for public speaking or building, whatever it is you have a gift for, that gift will be useful locally in some cause. And all you need, by the way, to be a group is one other person. You and one of your friends on a front porch or sitting in your apartment can form a group, and the two of you can find some little action to begin with that's going to make you feel like you're a part of something larger than yourself and get you started on a path toward reclaiming power. And the other is, make sure you're savoring your life. Make sure you're really enjoying yourself and doing everything you can to look at the sky, look at the stars, walk beside water when you can, to be with positive people who are actively engaged and trying to have an impact on the world. Whether or not we can change the world, I guarantee you, Steve, that will change us.
Mary Pfeiffer is a psychologist and author of the new book, The Green Boat. Thanks for joining us, Mary.
Thank you, Steve.
That's all, folks.